Hello and welcome to the Asian Cinema Film Club. I'm your host as always, Edward Jones, and joining me of course is my co-host, the Professor, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Howdy.
Welcome to the second of our recaps for Asian Horror Month. Hope you all enjoyed the first recap as we now enter into our second one here. And it's hit that point, Stephen, you know, where you wonder why you get yourself into this, which is always worrying when we're on the second recap and this normally hits around the third.
Well, I do wonder why you do this every year. You do this to yourself every year. And the fact that you're doubling up on it.
I know.
This is cinematic.
I just...
on onanism, this is, mate.
I think I'm just going to find a beat somewhere after this is done, just to like lie shipwrecked and comatose. Spend my days drinking fresh mango juice while goldfish shells nibble at my toes. You know. I mean, fun in the sun.
Very good.
Until then, it's time to continue with our rundown of the week that was here in Asian Cinema Month. Oh, not Asian Cinema Month, Asian Horror Month.
I was going to say, every month is Asian Cinema Month. But yes, in your duplicate horror month. So what have you been watching in Asian Cinema Horror?
Yes, because you obviously don't care about all the Western horror I've been watching, do you? It's all just the Asian horror that we're here for.
I'm sure you have other places to talk about the other stuff.
Surprisingly not. Okay, kicking things off, we had a film that is near and dear to ourselves here on the show, and that's Dumplings from 2004, directed by Fruit Chan. It's a rewatch, but I hadn't seen it in a while, and I really wanted to rewatch it. So here we are, once again, talking about Dumplings. It's one of the first films we ever talked about back in MBDS. We've talked about both Dumplings and Three Extremes multiple times on the show.
We could have pretended that was a banshee.
It's in my house. There's a ghost in my house. Obviously, if you're not familiar what Dumplings is, this follows a rich woman who is losing her attractiveness and as well as her husband's interest in her, and discovers some youth-restoring dumplings. This is the second time we've looked at something youth-restoring so far this season, because obviously in Zombie for Sale, it was a zombie youth-restoring bite, and this one is dumplings were a very special recipe. More so, they're cooked by Bei Ling, which should be a warning sign enough, because when has Bei Ling ever not been, like, kooky or crazy, or both?
Bei Ling is like this...
You're surprised to find her in the phone book. You think she'll be like on the moon or something, don't you?
She's this incredibly sexy woman that's also... I don't know what she's like in the real world, mate, but I imagine she's quite slightly batty in the real world. But she turns up in all kinds of places, doesn't she? She turns up in Transporter films. She turns up in episodes of Lost. She turns up in... Oh, crikey, what was that other thing she was in?
Well, I know her best from... I originally saw her in The Crow.
That's right. I mean, that's what I was trying to think of. Yes, that was like her first one. So, but she's in this. It's just... She is one of these sort of cross... I don't know if we could do a 31 Days of Bei Ling, but...
She's got 119 credits.
Oh, hello. And
yeah, as I said, she's in the Crank movies. Yeah. And she's in Star Wars Episode 3.
She is.
She played one of the senators.
Yeah.
She's in Southland Tales.
Of course she is.
who isn't in Southland Tales?
I'm waiting for you to do the minute by minute Southland Tales. I'm sure it's on your list.
You know, I keep saying that I'm going to do something with Southland Tales, but at the same time, it's a project that fills me with this sort of like sort of dread at not being at the level to do it justice. Because when you are in this sort of field, you sort of buy into the nonsense of everyone else and you think, oh, I'm not going to give it the proper academic treatment that it deserves. And then I'm just going to sound like I'm phoning it in. So that's why I don't sort of touch it. I just sort of burn bridges and ruin friendships with my love of that film. But yeah, she's, as I said, she's done a lot of DTV stuff. she's occasionally she comes over and does like stuff in Hong Kong.
Yeah, not so much though. I assume she's Chinese, isn't she? I don't know. But I remember she's in a really good episode of Lost, which explains where Jack gets all his tattoos from.
So you said a really good episode of Lost. Not the one with the Medusa spider. You know, not the one with we find out about the bunker, but the one we find out with Jack's tattoos.
Yeah, it was in that era, I think like season 3 of Lost, where a lot of people gave up with it, and I really got into it. I've got a strange relationship with Lost. I got quite bored quite early on, and then halfway through season 3 it did something and I thought, oh, I'm into this, and I think that's what turned everybody else off. And when they did flash forward season, I'm all for that.
It was surprising that Baling didn't really get sort of picked up to do more, really, because for this role, she got the Best Supporting Actress at the 2004 Hong Kong Film Awards, as well as the Golden Horse Awards in Taiwan the same year. So it really surprised me the fact that she didn't get picked up to do more projects other than this, because she is really fantastic in this, and she sort of really embraces this role. And I mean, there's three fantastic roles at the heart of this. We've got Miriam Yang here as Mrs. Lee, and we've also got Tony Leung Kai Fei as Mr. Lee, who's kind of a slimy sort of personality. And whether you watch the short version, whether it's in Free Extremes, or you watch this extended version, I think both versions stand on their own merits, and I think it's well worth checking out either version. I mean, you can watch the extended version, haven't seen the short version, and not feel that it loses anything at all. And alternatively, you can watch the shorter version, haven't seen the richer one, the longer version, and it will still be a satisfying experience. So,
absolutely. It bizarrely, you know, it stands as a short story in a novel, if you like. It's I suppose, I mean, Miriam Yang, this is you know, being in a horror movie is quite against type for her. She's one of these, she's what we recognize her from, she's the lead in Love and a Puff, isn't she?
Yes.
Big Tony Leung is in about a million things, and again, he's normally a bit more stoic and heroic, so he's playing a bit against type. But the thing about this story is it's because it's those that Three Extremes 2 collection has got, you know, people think of the Takashi Miike story and the Park Chan-wook story, and they're like the famous directors, right? And we talked a bit about with Rashmi last time we spoke to Rashmi about Fruit Chan, and actually Fruit Chan's got quite a CV, but he's not on that level of cult director. And this is nothing, it's like nothing else he's done. And it's just a really cracking story, but it's not just that. Do you remember, it's like the, you know, like when they eat the dumplings and you can hear the little bones crunching, there's like this sound design aspect to it. And it's sort of this complete package of visual and audio and a great cast and a great story with a killer twist. And that killer twist is the best kind of killer twist, because A, it's shocking the first time you hear it. But when you know what the twist is, the film still stands up. You're just repulsed earlier on, right? And it's and I think also, like you say, that sort of urge for youth and beauty is quite a nice universal horror trope, isn't it? That the I don't know, the spring of eternal youth, eating children to maintain, or blood or whatever like that. It's quite a common thing in horror, so it's quite nicely, you know, quite a lot of Asian horror is buried deep in Asian religious or supernatural lore. This is just based in everyone wants to live forever, right? And it could be, might not just be dumplings made from the fetuses of aborted children. It could be I don't know, something, pizza toppings or something. I don't know. It could work equally well, right?
That's yeah, what I like about it. I mean, it. Obviously that reveal really pushes the film into the grotesque, yet I think the real skill of the film is how Fruit Chan manages to land the film and keep it sort of in the same realm with the likes of Raw. So you've got this stomach-churning imagery, as you've been describing already, and then you play this against the moral quandaries that play with, you know, now you know the secret of the dumplings, are you still willing to cross that line? Because it obviously gives you so much personal gain. And we obviously have the scenes of her where she starts developing that that odd smell, which is still such a funny written scene. Where you've got her friends, it's like, what's that smell? And then she walks to the room, it's like, the smell disappeared. It's like, I'm not sure if this is like just bad translation or whether it was actually written like that, so.
No, I think it's right. I mean, do you know anybody who's done the keto diet?
No. What is the keto diet?
So the keto diet is when you completely cut carbohydrates out, right? And the idea is that your body goes into a status of keto status. Basically, your liver starts eating all the fat in your body. That's the idea. So you cut out all carbs. And it will, you know, your body starts eating itself. And one of the side effects is that your breath fucking stinks. But it's kind of that kind of thing, that urge for to be thin, look younger, all those kind of reasons you might go on the keto diet. Actually makes you fucking stink. That's what this is doing, isn't it? The fact that she's on this diet, she does look young, she's keeping her youth, but she stinks of death.
Yeah.
And so I think it might not come across quite, it is quite funny in translation, but I think it's genuinely coming from that. So there's a warning for any of you who want to go on the keto diet. You'll fucking stink.
Okay, next up we had the first film in the Yokai Monsters original trilogy, this one titled 100 Monsters, and really this is actually more of a atmospheric sort of ghost story than the sort of showcase of the monsters which the other films in the series are really like. So, but it's in the same sort of camp as Daijaman, and you know how Daijaman only really shows up at the end, which is kind of... Really, we obviously had that connection to Daijaman because the director of Daijaman is Yoshikiro Kuroda, who here provides the effects for this film and would also go on to direct the next two installments in the series. He also directed Sonny Chiba's Shadow Warriors as well, who, let's not forget, was a key inspiration for his character of Hattori Hanzo in Kill Bill. But, yeah, this is, as I said, this is more about atmosphere. I mean, we have a couple of cool monsters that show up all the way through, like a snake-necked woman and this wacky umbrella monster. But really, I mean, this is just like an Edo-era set ghost story, which focuses on this greedy developer who's looking to knock down a shrine so he can build a brothel, only to soon find himself plagued by the spirits when he refuses to do a cleansing ritual after hosting a 100 ghost story ceremony. This is really big on atmosphere, and it's incredibly stylish and looks absolutely fantastic to see. And the monsters themselves don't really turn up until really the finale, where we get to see all their weird and wacky designs. And I think it's when they turn up, it's a really fun scene, and the designs themselves are really great, especially because these are yokai, so they're sort of, as I said, while the ghost spirits have also got that sort of weird monster design to them as well. So I think, as I said, it throws in some really fun ideas there and managed to hold my interest, even though we're not getting to see the monsters on screen as much as we do in other installments in this ongoing series.
So I haven't seen this one. They did a, if you want to say Arrow, but somebody did a box set of this and Spook Warfare and the first Takeshi Miike Great Yokai War, which I have seen a couple of years ago, basically as preparation, because Miike did a sequel to the Great Yokai War. And I do have, I have the review copies, because which isn't as exciting as it used to be. It's just I've got links on Vimeo. It doesn't mean I've physically got Blu-rays or anything of them. I really enjoyed Miike's Great Yokai War, actually.
Yeah, we covered that back in Miike Month, which
That's
is the
right,
fourth
we
one.
Did. Yeah. Which is more like just a remake of earlier ones. It's not really a... But it was a huge amount of fun. And so I always wanted to go back and watch some of the other ones. And also there's films like Kitaro and the Millennium Curse, and which is another film with like these yokai, and these yokai are in sort of, in my head I had a feeling they were not real folklore, but they are. But you'll see all over Japan, they'll, a bit like the mascots, there'll be things of these weird spirits. You know, you've pointed her out already. There's one that's like an umbrella. There's people with incredibly long limbs. So some of them are just like weird looking people, and some of them are just abstract to the max. And they're kind of, some of them are kind of charming and funny. And that's I'm surprised when you say they don't turn up until the end. That's interesting, but I'm not expecting it to be very scary. Let's put it that way.
Oh no, no, it's far from scary. But it's more just, as I said, they're just more like tormenting spirits. You know, like a cautionary tale, where you know the evil lander upsets the spirits, and they sort of spend their time pranking him. And at the end, you see him wandering off with like these large barrels of sake, which is about as threatening as they get, really. I mean, we get a giant head, but really, I think any harm that comes to people is just sort of indirect. It's not anything that they do themselves, so it's not poltergeist. It's as I said, these are just mischievous spirits that are portrayed as here, with the real sort of story being the focus on, as I said, this evil landlord wanting to knock down a shrine so he can build a brothel.
Yeah, I mean, this is a Daiei film, isn't it? So the that's where Daijimin comes from as well. So they're coming up with ideas to counter stuff like Godzilla and the like. So I guess that's where it's come from. But yeah, I will at some point check this out, because it seems a shame to have them all and not watch them.
Well, they're on the Arrow player. You can watch all four, including Mikkei's first one. So they're all available to watch on there. And there's also, they put out the box set as well. So
cool.
As I said, if you do like them, then you can own the box set as well. Next up, we have a film which barely sort of scrapes in to the horror category, and we included it mainly because it has zombies in it, and that's a film that Stephen really wanted to see.
Is this going to be Nulgulamar Z?
Yay, Nulgulamar Z, Gothic Lolita Battle Bear.
I haven't got around to watching it, but you're going to tell me. Tell everybody about it.
Okay, well, this is directed by Noboru Iguchi, whose filmography includes like Mutant Girl Squad, Robot Geisha, and The Machine Girl. So I think you've seen The Machine Girl. I think you've mentioned,
I mean, I talked about Machine Girl last time. I love this shit, right? I think
you love a high concept title, don't you? So
I love the high concept title. It's not just that. I love these movies, and he does a lot of them. He's done he did one of the Tomy movies. He's
he did Ass of the Dead as well.
Dead Sushi, absolutely. More than one Machine Girl movie, actually. But he makes, and I've just seen another one, which I was about to say, the kind of low rent, high concept movies, usually with some girl in a sailor suit that's either got a weapon or some kind of mutation or something like that. And they are kind of silly, but the heart's in the right place. And you think they're going to be like low rent softcore porn, but they're never really quite like that, although some of them in his, just having a look through, it's a cinematic scene, but on the whole they're not, but they look like they're going to be naughty, and instead they're just silly. Yep. And this one, I saw it on your watch list that you put up on Letterboxd, and I thought, well, that's an interesting, I thought it was going to be an anime, because lots of what you watch is anime, and I saw the picture, the poster, and I thought, I need to watch that, and I have picked up a copy, I just haven't got around to watching it yet. But yeah, please tell everybody what this is about and okay. tell me it's wonderful.
Well, this one is on YouTube as well, so you can kind of check it out on there. But it basically follows a gothic Lolita who's kind of a klutz, and she merges with a talking teddy bear that's possessed by an alien spirit so that she can battle music-influenced zombies that have been unleashed in Tokyo, as well as a girl with a machine gun arm and another who throws spoons at her as a weapon. So, yeah. I have to say that, you know, Marvel could learn a lot from this film, as we're about 15 minutes in and already she's got her superpower, she's set up an origin story and is already battling zombies and machine gun welding women. And this isn't even including the middle-aged man baby who they use to unleash the zombies, because nobody can blame a baby. And of which they get to do the bidding by having the girl with the machine gun arm eat food really sloppily, because that's his thing.
Fantastic. I will watch this. Like I say, I've got a copy of it. However, you just slagged off Marvel. One thing I did this week, nothing to do with horror movies,
okay,
is I'd only ever watched Batman Begins. I'd never seen The Dark Knight or Dark Knight Rises, okay? Because when I went to see Batman Begins at the cinema, I fell asleep. And that 2005? So 18 years later, I thought I'd better fix that, because I do consider myself a comic book fan. But again, Batman Begins takes about 2 fucking hours to get to that point, and it's not even got a real origin story. It's, oh my god, those films are so overrated. And yeah, anyway, but that's just a sidebar. I think the DC movies are just as bad, and Christopher Nolan is the worst freaking offender of all. So the fact that you just get it, you get it all on the plate within 15 minutes, mate, I'm there for. I just love the image of the, I guess it's the girl merged with a teddy bear, but it's got, it's like I don't know, it's just some rando cosplays what it looks like, and I'm there for it.
Yeah, it's kind of like a fairy.
Mm.
But at the same time, combined. Do you remember Farscape? The character is Scorpio.
Yeah, vaguely. I know what you mean. Yeah,
basically,
yeah.
What the face looks like on this. So she's obviously got this weird bear costume that obviously has magic bear powers. And the teddy bear actually talks, so it can interact on its own. And at one point, it has a gun.
I am getting flashbacks to 1970s British comedy and Roger DeCourcy and Nookie Bear, though.
But I mean, this is. I mean, this is a film that is really a lot of fun, and it does also live up to its title, which, you know, is a positive. And at the same time, it manages to constantly surprise you, because even when you think it's reached like the zenith of its absurdity, we then get scenes such as like the topless girls who use embarrassment power so they can fly up and rain down lasers on the city, or the fact that our heroine is at one point surfing a car through the skies while she battles the film's big evil. And yeah, the CGI is rather cheap in places, but again, this is Japanese cinema. We often get a lot of cheap looking CGI, but at the same time, it's got a lot more warmth to cheap CGI from, like, you know, the likes of Asylum and the Sci-Fi Channel and stuff. So it kind of like knows that CGI is bad and sort of pushes it even further into like the absurdity, because it knows that, you know, if you bought this into the film this far, then, you know, sure, why not? But I wouldn't be opposed to a sequel if they ever made one to this. At the moment, there is no plans for a sequel, but, you know, when you're locked into a big movie binge, this is the kind of junk food that you need.
Sorry, I stuck on mute there. Yeah, I'm all for this, and I'm definitely going to watch it. However, I am getting more disturbed as I have a quick look through Nobuo Uematsu's catalogue. Because I've just found one. And the fact that the poster is pixelated on Letterboxd, which I don't know if that's...
Oh, that means it's an adult title. You've got to change your settings so you can look at the boobie titles. I don't want to
because it's called Hypertrophy Genitals Girl. Japanese schoolgirls have a curse placed on them that causes them to have enlarged male genitals.
Of course.
It's high concept. Shit. I'm there for... It's all fun, isn't it? And that's... It's playful fun and a little bit naughty, but not disturbing. And I'm there for it. So yeah, I'll definitely check out what was it called? Nui Galoma Z.
Yeah. Next up, we have Digital Devil Story Megumi Tensei, which is another OVA Odyssey from the 80s. This one spawned some RPG games, which I think is what most people know this series more from than this OVA, which did actually get a sequel. This one sees Yumiko, who's the new girl in school, and finds out that nothing is quite what it seems, especially because the handsome student Akimi is not only a computer genius, but also is using his computer skills to summon cyber demons, in particular the demon Loki. This is another OVA that, much like Battle Royale High School, I had like really high hopes for, and it only devolved into a state of overwhelming confusion as to what was supposed to be happening. So if you've seen this and understand what the plot was, please feel free to send us a postcard and let us know what the plot was. But you know, there's some fun old school anime horror here with people being enveloped with a blob-like creature before exploding in sprays of blood, and there's fun demon designs to be found. But you know, it's a very detached experience, but at the same time also a breezy 45, so you know, it sort of swings and roundabouts really with this one.
So I haven't obviously seen this, but you piqued my interest when you said it had loads of role playing games and stuff that sort of spun out of it. And mate, there's a million games that have spun, including the Persona series, which I am aware of. You know, I'm not that old that I am aware of some of the kids are playing. But my God, it's a veritable empire. I don't know any game that's that. There's even one for the Virtual Boy, interestingly. But
do you own a Virtual Boy? Is that the red screen
that's
one?
That's the sort of the 3D rests on a desk and you sort of lean into it. It was invented by the guy who invented the Game Boy and basically got him kicked out of Nintendo. They're pretty rare. I haven't got one in my collection. I may one day. But the point is, it's everything from Virtual Boy to PC-98s to PlayStation 4s. This is a long-standing franchise that I could see. This could be the only franchise you ever knew, and you still wouldn't have time to play all the games.
Yeah.
Mate, it's like about 7 pages on Wikipedia, just the list of the games. Wow. But you haven't inspired me to go and watch the OVA.
Oh, what a shame. Next up, we got Vampire Hunter D, which is another of those titles, if you're of a certain age, will be up there in that higher echelon of anime titles alongside the likes of Akira and Ghost in the Shell. But time, it seems, has not been particularly kind to us. It's now like really kind of, it's sort of slowly falling into that lost media category with the likes of, you know, like Roll, Space Force, Wings of Onimusha. And it's really kind of confusing because it is a really accessible title, and it feels that, much like Ninja Scroll, that you would think it would have retained its popularity, even though the animation is a little dated, it feels. But, you know, it takes the traditional vampire head Vampire Hunter setup and transplants it into a post-apocalyptic future where somehow it's the post-apocalyptic future, yet it still looks like the 18th century, but we can now have lasers and cyber horses and a character like Dee, who is basically one of the most overpowered characters in the all of anime. Here he teams up with the daughter of a werewolf hunter called Doris, who finds herself attacked by the vampire lord Count Magnus Lee, who, having infected with his bite, leads her to hiring Dee to help vanquish the Count, who's also got an army of supernatural minions, including werewolves and demons, which only sort of add to the fun. This is also based on the manga by Hideyuki Kukiuchi, who also created Wicked City and Demon City Shinjuku, which have also got fantastic animes attached to them as well. And while this is marked as the first animated horror film for adults, it doesn't feel that it sort of hits as hard as those titles, and more that the likes of like Legend of the Overfiend or LA Blue Girl, even though there are obviously moments of violence and bloodshed, but certainly pales in comparisons to some of the other titles that followed in its wake, especially when we look at like a lot of the 90s titles. But you know, there's a strong story, colorful cast of characters, and interesting monsters to battle. And if you're a fan of Castlevania, I think that this will really resonate with yourselves as well.
So, when you we had a little chat over social media. Was it today, yesterday, when you were pointing me out where you can find all these films?
Oh, yeah.
And this actually has been on my long-term watch list. So, again, I think maybe linked to the conversation either we had last week or a couple of weeks ago, Vampire Hunter D is one of those properties that I remember from back in the day. Possibly more from being manga. Along with Blood, the one Blood the Last Vampire. Those two I've always seemed to remember being around as long as I've been aware of manga, you know what I mean? So it is sort of on that long term watch par. And like you say, it looks like to me it's got that Castlevania vibe. It's got that here's the future, but it's looks like the Middle Ages. It's sort of a cyberpunky kind of thing, but not. I don't know. It's hard to explain, but I know exactly what you mean. You know, the world's gone backwards, but there's still robot horses, that kind of thing, right? It actually sounds like it ticks a lot of my boxes. So you never know. I may have a watch of this.
So last on our catch-up tonight, we have Gokke Body Snatcher from Hell, which Rashmi recommended. So I'm on to slowly working into the recommendations part of this month. So there will be more recommendations that you, the listeners, have been sending across. Gokke Body Snatcher from Hell. I'm just going to read the letterbox blurb here, and it says a fiendish vampire from a strange world in outer space drains his victim's blood and turns them into weird corpses. That'd be one way of explaining this.
But then I was looking at the same thing, but then the second paragraph, I guess it didn't seem quite match, but I get it. So yeah, so yeah. Some people crash and there's this alien vampire goes around and kills them.
Yeah, basically this could fall into the same category as like Mantango.
Right, yeah.
So if you like Mantango, I think you'll really like this one. But again, in terms of like pacing, I mean, in the opening 10 minutes, we establish all we need to know about this film. Basically, you have a group of people on a plane that is flying through a weird blood red sky. There's birds that are committing suicide by throwing themselves against the windows of the plane. Well, inside, it's kind of like a Pan Am Pan Am experience. There's like none of those like farty little bottles of spirits. They got like huge bottles of spirits being wheeled around by the glamorous air hostess. At the same time, they get the flight control, like, say, oh, there's someone who's got a bomb on the plane. So they're trying to find out who's got the bomb on the plane. This is all, again, all within the first 10 minutes. The plane then suffers a weird mechanical meltdown when a glowing UFO flies at the plane, causing them to crash into a quarry. And then soon, strangeness occurs as one of the passengers gets possessed by a strange blob-like creature that comes out of the UFO and starts preying on the other passengers as a weird alien vampire. Again, all in the first 10 minutes. This is a wild movie. This is so weird and wild and crazy.
Yeah, and again, I'm just sort of quickly reading through people's reviews, and it's actually, people, if you like this kind of movie, it's got really excellent reviews. And I think, you know, we are probably the audience. This is probably where our tastes, this is the Venn diagram of our tastes. This is, because I like things that are really fucking weird.
I'm surprised that Parker over at Junk Food didn't like this. He only gave this 3 stars. Right. And he also points out that the fact that Body Snatcher is actually from space, not hell. Which is true.
And they're not really Body Snatchers either. But yeah, there's some... I can see what's going on. So how did you watch this? Was it on...
This one I found on Archive, but if you've got access to the Criterion channel, then you can find it on there as well.
Which is why it's showing up as an Amazon thing. Right, gotcha.
So it's very easy to get hold of, so... So you can definitely check this out. But this one is directed by Heijumi Saito, who also directed Terror Beneath the Sea and The Golden Bat. But as I say, when you watch this, it's very similar to Mantango. I didn't enjoy this as much as Mantango. And I feel that at the times it gets a little too weird to sort of justify bringing it to the show, but we may like cover it at some point down the line. But I would be very interested to hear either way what you thought of this one, because it's as I said, it certainly throws some interesting ideas at the screen. At the same time, the plotting is equally interesting, such as where you've got two of the passengers who get rather amorous. In the first hour, I would say, of the film, them having crashed in the plane. Meanwhile, one of the other passengers is just sat there watching them getting it on. You've got the people who are smoking next to the jet fuel, which is also really funny. We've got them in this quarry setting. So, again, you like Doctor Who, so that will be fit into your world.
Yeah, I have a quarry.
They have a quarry or a car park. It's normally the two places Doctor Who likes to be.
I like a quarry and a rubber monster. That'll keep me happy.
Yeah, so while it's got this sort of like B-movie aesthetic to it, there's some really impressive effects in this film as well, which is worth checking out. So just like how the blob-like alien moves and takes over people. And there's some really great modes taken of some of the cast who's... heads that it's shown crawling into. So yeah, I think it's worth definitely giving a watch. It's certainly one of the more fun films that we've watched so far in this season. I think it's certainly been it's certainly a highlight worth checking out. So if you've got access to the Criterion channel, watch it on there, or you can always go on archive.org and watch it on there as well. So
yeah, sounds interesting. I'll definitely check it out myself.
So yeah, that was obviously the week that was.
So I have one to bring, if that's okay. You're going to watch 31 films. So I've watched one.
Yeah, we're really holding the table up here, aren't we?
Well, yeah. Obviously, I spent 9 hours, or what it felt like 9 hours, with Christopher Nolan this month, and I did need a little bit of a palate cleanser. So about a year ago, Eureka released it's not really a box set, it's just some DVDs rammed into a single case of the Mr. Vampire movies, or some of them. So obviously they'd done the original Mr. Vampire movie some time ago, but they did Mr. Vampire 2 and 3 and 4, although it's not really 4, and another rando one, basically. All the Mr. Vampire films that were directed by, just remind myself, Ricky Lau.
Right.
Right. So Mr. Vampire, I can't think we've talked about it before. Surprised we haven't actually done it as an episode.
I think we've talked about hopping vampires before.
We have, but there was just a Mr. Vampire was incredibly successful, and Sammo Hung's connected to most of these movies as well, and so there was just a bunch of sequels, there's a bunch of imitators, a bunch of rip-offs. Anyway, Eureka put this box out, and it has sat on my desk where I'm talking to you now, which is also where I work most of the time, for a year. And I thought, you know what? It is Halloween. I should watch it. So I only watched the first one, which is Mr. Vampire 2, which is, I believe, amongst fans, the one that has the least popularity. Because it's a bit childish. So basically what happens is this archaeologist and a couple of his mates uncover three corpses, let's put it that way, and they're clearly a family. There's a man, there's a woman, and there's a young child, and they sort of bring them back, and but they're not corpses, they're vampires, and they've got the whole Taoist, you know, the little yellow, I forget what they call it, but you know, the bits of paper with the writing on that's hold them in suspended animation. The child escapes and goes off and has another adventure with two young children, and riffs on E.T.
As you do.
I kid you not, as you do. Meanwhile, for the next half an hour, the assistants of the archaeologist go into sort of slapstick battle with these two corpses of the male and female ghost vampire thing. And then, for some reason, well, there is a good reason, but Yun Biao turns up. Probably because he's mates with Sammo Hung, who's the producer of this. And Moon Lee, she turns up as well. And it turns into a Yun Biao movie where he kind of takes on these vampires, but he's obviously quite good at kung fu and stuff. There's this amazing sequences. So there's one sort of 15-minute sequence where, for reasons, it's done in slow motion, but, you know, they're acting as if it's slow motion, yeah? And it's like this knockdown, drag-out battle where everyone's pretending they're being infected. It's a classic Hong Kong, I'm afraid. It's called a retarded gas.
Okay, of course.
You know, of course it is. But it's really rather good. And then later on, they get out, the vampire creatures get out into the streets. And there's this really epic battle out in the streets where you see the vampires bouncing on police cars. And it's so the original Mr. Vampire films is a period piece. This is very much set in the modern day. And I can see why lots of people don't like it. And the young boy child vampire is called OK Boy. Is a figure of fun in Asian cinema circles. They sort of say, oh, this is one of the worst films ever. I'm going to be honest with you, mate. I enjoyed the shit out of it. I thought it was. It's that kind of just knockabout Asian comedy. Obviously, I'm a huge fan of Stephen Chow, as we know, and we'll talk about on a future episode yet again when we talk about King of Comedy. But I just like these. You just know they got to work and they made it up on the fly every day, and some of the jokes fit and some of the jokes don't, but actually you have got someone like Yun Biao in it who's bloody good at what he does, right? So it can't, you know, certain scenes and sequences can't help but be good. It doesn't take itself too seriously. Will I watch it again and again? Will it become my Halloween rotation? Of course it won't. It's nowhere, you know, Mr. Vampire's a 10, this is a 6, but it was an enjoyable 6. And I think it kind of fits in with the kind of films that you've been, you know, you've been covering the whole spectrum of Asian horror, from, you know, girls that are morphing into teddy bears to you know, body snatchers going in through slits through heads, through to, you know, we talk about Dark Water, blah blah blah, you know, there's a whole gamut of it. This isn't scary, this is funny.
Yeah,
but it is actually quite well. I don't know if you've seen it. I enjoyed it, but I know it's got a very mixed reputation. But it has inspired me to watch the rest of the films on that box set, because I need to stop buying things that I don't watch.
Well, you said you do like to
amass things. I'm a physical media boy. I'm a physical media boy. And some stuff's happened this week. Ah, well, we won't talk about Doctor Who, but the very first four episodes of Doctor Who won't be available on streaming anymore. So I'm glad I've got my DVD of it.
Which first four episodes of Doctor Who?
Oh, Unearthly Child and the three episodes, that the very first four, real Doctor Who, not modern Doctor Who, William Hartnell Doctor Who, the guy that the rights have. So with BBC programmes of the time, or any British programme at the time,
yeah,
the sort of the rights kind of go to the scriptwriter.
Okay.
And the guy who wrote the script has passed away. It's passed to his son. His son has become a conspiracy theorist, transphobe, bigot, weirdo. But he maintains that the BBC caused his dad to die of overwork back in the day. So he's got the rights to 2040. And he's refusing to give them, BBC, the rights to put the first four episodes onto iPlayer. So, you know, it's like the 60th anniversary of Doctor Who this year.
Right, okay.
Maybe you do, maybe you don't. So one of the things they're doing is they're going to put every episode of Doctor Who onto the BBC iPlayer.
That time.
Believe it or not, it's not on there, right? In fact, it's really weird what's going on. And that, of course, that'll just be in the UK, because Disney have bought the world rights. But, yeah, so basically they've gone to this guy and said, you know, we want to put it on iPlayer. This is how much we're offering. And he's such a prick, he's gone, no. Now, there's a lot of... it's very easy for me to say he's a prick. You know, I think he's got some issues. And I think he has got a beef, whether it's a genuine beef or not, I don't know. 10 years ago, he tried to sue the BBC because he said his dad made up the name TARDIS. This is that guy.
Right, okay. Right?
Okay, but yes, but basically there's a huge announcement as part of the 60th anniversary. Every episode ever of Doctor Who's going to be on iPlayer, and like you say, about time. And then a week later they said, except for the first four episodes. Now, as it turns out, the very first episode of Doctor Who is very good. The other three episodes in that serial is when Doctor Who and the gang go to Doctor Who and the gang. They go and see the Tribe of Gum. It's all set in caveman times.
Yes.
And it's pretty fucking dire, right? It's no great loss. And then can just get, so they basically, it'll just start at the first Dalek story, which again is quite dire. But it's, you know, it's where you are. It's just a bit of history. And this guy, basically, the way that rights go on, I think he'll have the rights to 2040. And obviously, he signed off the rights to other mechas, so you can still get it on DVD. It's just the streaming rights that he won't give up, so... Where would I go? Where do we start on this? Oh, streaming. Yes, yes. So that was the point. That was the point. So not everything will always be on streaming. So I'm still a big believer in basically surrounding myself with plastic discs. The chance that things might disappear. But of course, that's why, you know, things like archive.org for some of this stuff is vital.
I think it's important to preserve media. I think at the time, at the same time, there's the great thing about archive.org is it's providing the library that we so sorely need for a lot of material that would otherwise get lost, especially the way that YouTube is so finicky with what counts as copyright strikes, and the fact that you can't show certain things. This is where you, if you watch anything on YouTube now, you see a lot of their creators like put black boxes over nudity. They bleep out curse words and stuff because, you know, they, YouTube can demonetize them, and Yeah, so I think, as I said, things like archive.org, things like Rare Films, is these little subsections of the internet are really important to have, as they help preserve a lot of media that may be lost.
Absolutely. And there's a huge difference between pirating a Marvel movie or Gone with the Wind, even, and some of these films which are being preserved, some of this Gonzo stuff, you know, things like the film you just talked about. Although you said it's on the Criterion Channel, so maybe it's got its fans, but there's a lot of movies, international movies, student movies, that just won't ever get picked up, and they will get lost. And there's, you know, we both know this, isn't there, like, there's like whole rafts of Japanese and Korean cinema that's been lost forever. You know, can't get it back.
Yeah, certainly when you look at some of the titles out there, and we look at things such like Penguin's Memory, which nobody's actually sure who owns it. It's rights are that complicated. And if it makes you feel any better, Joe Dante says it's okay. And Tarantino says it's okay, because they, as I said, Tarantino openly says that don't bother giving Bezos any more money. They don't need any more money. Just pirate it. So
yeah, I think as situations demand. But Penguin's Memory is a classic example. Yes, we found it, or you found it, on YouTube.
Oh yeah, it was exploding. Yeah. Will for exploding helicopter. Who found it? And in YouTube, I think, is the only place where it exists outside of like a laserdisc.
There's a Japanese laserdisc. It's the only place I could find it, but you can't obviously get anymore. And laserdiscs are, laserdiscs are an analog technology, and they rot just like CDs do.
Yeah, they suffer from laser rot, which means that, and the flippers as well, which makes it even worse. So you could lose half a film because you've got laser rot on your side A.
Absolutely. I mean, they are nice looking objets d'art, laser disc, I have to say. I've got a couple of laser discs, but I've got no laser disc player. But something I'm on the hunt for.
Find a lot of people saying them as like broken, but finding an unbroken one is a little more difficult.
And it's very expensive to find it, or you'll find that they won't have the remote control with them, which makes them absolutely freaking useless.
Oh really? There's no buttons on there. It's surprising as well, because a lot of things of that era sort of had it attached with the umbilical cord, didn't they? So
they did, and of course a lot of it's only composite output, and so modern TVs can't accept it.
No,
same problem I have with my retro computing. You know, it's challenges maintaining a television that's got all the right connectors on the back, which luckily, as you might guess, I do. But yes, that we both agreed that was a great film, a hidden gem. If it got the right marketing, I'm sure someone could put it out. But the rights, you know, lots of things are lost in the mists of time. Millions of TV shows have been lost. Millions of, you know, again, as a Doctor Who fan, famously, there's hundreds of episodes that got wiped by the BBC, but there are hundreds upon hundreds of British television shows that have been lost. You know, things like episodes of the Morecambe and Wise show, things that you thought would have just been saved because they were episodes of Dad's Army, are lost. You know, things that we think are just part of the national, I don't know, zeitgeist have gone, right? So where people do, you know, I feel quite strongly about this, where people are archiving and recording television shows and movies to a certain degree, I think, and computer games is another one, probably something close to our hearts. I think it's really important to preserve this stuff, because online streaming things won't last forever, and things will go and disappear. I mean, I've suffered it on iTunes. Apple lose the rights to a piece of music. You try and sync your mobile device to Apple, to the iTunes store, and loads of it's gone. Not loads of it, but some of it's gone. And you thought you owned it, but you don't. You don't own anything, mate. Even if you buy something on Amazon, you know, a film on Amazon, and you spend your £6 or your £10, that's no guarantee it'll be there in a year's time, which is disgusting. So that's why I have physical media. More than I'll ever be able to watch. And it'll all rot away. So, you know.
Cool.
That was Stephen's rant. That's Stephen's...
That's your contribution to this
week. That's my contribution tonight, is a rant about that support piracy.
Yeah, so it's piracy good, Doctor Who scriptwriter's son bad, and BBC adding Doctor Who to streaming, apart from if you're outside the UK. But to be honest, it's about time. I think BritBox had all the Doctor Who before
it did, the iPlayer.
They were on the Horror Channel before the BBC put them on. And it's bizarre the fact that they've never been on the iPlayer until now.
BritBox is, yeah. So BritBox was a bit weird anyway, because it was like a co-production with the BBC and ITV, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was between them, and then they added, what, Channel 5 and Channel 4, and it's... Yeah.
A bit weird, but now ITVX is sort of taking over from that, I think. I'm not quite sure what the future of BritBox is, but that's always a thing. It's always a streaming service. I thought, oh, if I didn't have five others, that might come into the fifth. But yeah, it's absolutely bizarre that the BBC, the stuff that's on iPlayer is really weird. So historical stuff. There's weird films on iPlayer as well. Just why is that film on iPlayer? They're advertising it at Boiling Point, which has been on Netflix for 3 years, and you think, why is it on iPlayer? It's got nothing to do with the BBC. But anyway.
Oh, well, I think it's the series Boiling Point, as in the kitchen drama one.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've just made it into a series.
They made a series of the movie with this Liverpudlian actor.
Yeah.
It's like, the film is like done in real time, he says, Bunny Earing.
But yeah, I saw it had Jason Fleming, I think it is.
Yes, okay, yes.
Who I get sort of creepy vibes from, so I just didn't bother watching it, and then...
Wow, did you know his dad was the director of Dalek Invasion Earth 2150 that we watched? Gordon Fleming is his dad.
Oh, really?
There you go. I can bring everything back to Doctor Who if you want to. Should we do that as a challenge, one episode?
And now he makes films in Russia.
He does. He has got a very eclectic career. But he was in Lockstock, wasn't he?
He was in Lockstock, yeah. And, well, other people in Lockstock went on to memorable things. He didn't. He just turns up in odd roles for the producer of Lockstock, whose name I can't remember now.
Guy Ritchie. The director, I mean?
No, because the guy who produced it went on to do Layer Cake.
He did, yes. That's another good
one. And they were like, oh, he was clearly the most talented one, because he did like Stardust, and then I can't remember, he did something afterwards, and they was like, oh, maybe he's not as talented as we thought, so.
Jason Fleming is a guy who always seems to have work. Do you know what I mean? He's sort of like, but he doesn't really care where he goes to do it. You're right, he has done some stuff in Russia, hasn't he? And then he'll appear on TV shows, and then he'll appear as third heavy from the left in a Hollywood movie. And
I tell you, for myself, he's like, I'm just double checking the name here, but he's kind of like the less exciting version of Michael Smiley, who's in a bunch of Ben Wheatley movies.
Okay, yeah.
He played the bike carrier in Spaced.
Yes.
And since then, he's like, he's in a whole bunch of Wheatley movies. Whose film Kill List I also watched this week, so.
Yeah, I mean, he's in a ton of stuff. He's one of Matey Boy's favourites as well, isn't he? Edgar Wright's favourites.
Okay.
He's in Shaun of the Dead and The World's End.
Yep.
Blimey, he's in a million bloody things. Wow. But again, that talks to that point, isn't it? Somebody that's just never out of work. But you do wonder how they make money.
By being a working actor. That's how you make money.
And Stephen Graham was the Liverpudlian bloke in Boiling Point I was trying to think of, who was in a film with Michael Smiley. That's how I just saw his picture.
Stephen Graham, who was in This Is England.
Indeed.
He was the happy-go-lucky sidekick in Snatch. And then he's in This Is England as a skinhead neo-Nazi.
Yeah, he's a fascinating one. And yes, Jason Fleming was in the movie of Boiling Point. And oh, we could. There is something. There is a show here, mate, that we could do.
Don't start throwing ideas out. You know that it's just going to end up being another thing that we're going to end up doing.
I'm just thinking, Stephen and Elwood spend 40 minutes going through Letterboxd, right? But jumping, and we have a start point, and we see where we get. You know, do you ever do that thing with Wikipedia where you look something up, and then suddenly it's 4 hours later, and you're 17 things removed from the thing you just wanted to look up?
Oh yeah, but I like the darker recesses of Wikipedia. There's a page which has got like the dark recesses, and it's things like Spite House, which is where you. You spite your neighbour by building a property just to use up a piece of land that they want.
This happens to me all the time. I look up something and then I'll just... It'll either spark another idea or I go down a link and then I'm just... It's not like the Kevin Bacon game where everything's only six steps away. It's like you're in another universe away and then 2 hours has passed. You think, how did I get there? And I do think there's a letterbox game that you could play. Where you could just start the show. One of us just says, right, we're going to start with, I don't know, the film From Hell.
Okay.
And let's just see where we end up in 40 minutes' time. If anyone would like to hear that show, comment and let's... I'm trying to think quite how it would work, but just the nature of Letterboxd.
So you want to play the Letterboxd game.
Yeah, but we need to invent the game. That's the point. We need some rules. Let's have a community invent the rules and turn it into a show. I think there's some legs in this, mate.
If you'd like to comment on anything mentioned in tonight's show, you can do via our Facebook page. We are also on Instagram, and we are also on Threads and Blue Sky as well. So come say hi to us there. Let us know your thoughts on anything in tonight's episode. You can also check out our blog, which is asiancinemafilmclub.wordpress.com. And also please do hit the like and subscribe button wherever you happen to listen to us. Leave us a review. Let us know what you think of the show, especially on iTunes, as it really helps with the algorithm there for people leaving us reviews. So thank you to everyone who's done that already. And until next time, thank you as always for listening. Keep looking out for our special spooky episodes. We just put out our episode on The Vanishing as part of the World Cinema Film Club. We've got an episode on Uncle Boomy Who Can Recall His Past Lives coming up this week as well, so keep a lookout for that as well. But until then, thank you for listening. Thank you to my co-host Stephen.
You're very welcome, but good luck editing this one.
And we'll be back next week with another recap of the week that was. But until then, good night. We'll be right back.